Hey, friend.
Hey, girl. Hey.
I'm so excited for this episode.
Oh, we are back with an episode on people pleasing.
And particularly people pleasing at big age.
Yes.
Which I think is maybe a little bit different than pleasing in other age groups.
For sure. And I think it has a lot to do also with the role that society plays and how we are kind of indoctrinated or how we're raised. It's cultural. There's so many things that play into this that I think are going to be uncovered in today's episode.
Absolutely. Okay, so before we get started, can you share something new that you've done over the last couple months or happened to you?
Something new or something that happened to me? Well, one thing is I've been bike riding. You know this, but I don't know if our audience know that I'm now an avid bike rider, Margo.
So I wouldn't go avid.
She
has her own bike, though.
I have a bike. I have a helmet. I even have one of those like things you put on, like a romper, and it has a padded like thing for your butt so the bike doesn't hurt your booty. Yeah, I've been out here. I've been outside on the bike, and it has been... I'm not going to say great because I actually don't really enjoy it. But for me, I don't enjoy most forms of physical activity outside of shopping and sex. Yeah, but that's just
walking?
Me. Well, I do like walking for sure. Doesn't really increase the heart rate as much as I would like, but it's healthy and it's great to move. But it's so interesting because I find people who are like really into exercise or movement so interesting because I'm not an athlete. Like I've never played a sport. I wasn't a dancer. I just don't have that thing in my brain that gets excited about sweating.
When you were little, you didn't have to do a sport for your school or anything?
Mm-mm. I grew up playing like kickball or I don't know,
hopscotch
or whatever. Yeah, but I couldn't go far. My grandparents were very strict, so I could like ride my bike to the stop sign and back. I couldn't even ride it around our small country town, like around the block. So yeah, this is actually very interesting because I think about this a lot. The feds had this program called, this is my nerd coming, Moving to Opportunity. It was, don't look at me like that. This is going to be a quick story that people have got to hear. It was a HUD program where they said, let's take poor families, take them out the hood and move them to the suburbs. And they
like
found
busing?
It was like busing, but for families long term. So almost like you got a Section 8 voucher, but it was specifically
to a suburb.
And what they found is that there were these gendered experiences where girls had improved outcomes and boys did not. Likely because boys were being hyper-policed, right? It's black kids in the suburbs. They're male. They're seen as a threat, et cetera. And what they found is that the girls spent much more time at home in the house. So they were able to kind of have the benefit of a better academic experience, and then they came straight home. And so they weren't perceived as a threat in their environment. I bring that up because as it relates to me, a lot of my time was spent either in my house or on my front porch. There was no out-of-school time program. There was no Boys and Girls Club. There were no out-of-school activities that most of us did. And my grandma, by the time I was probably in middle school, she got home around the same time I did off the bus. My grandma was a domestic worker, for folks who don't know. But it just wasn't something that was privileged or valued in a real way. Part of it is obviously we didn't have a lot of disposable income. But also, I think girls were just very much parented in a different way. Stay close to home. This is where you are safe. So yeah, no physical activity was ever seen as fun for me. School was my outlet. Church was my outlet.
Mm. And I learned that you were in the choir.
Yeah, I was in the children's choir. Shout out to First Baptist Missionary Baptist Church.
Grandma told me.
Children's choir. Yeah.
She was like, you didn't know that Tashira was in the choir? I said, no, Grandma Mae.
Yeah, exactly. All of my black churchisms likely were because that was such a fundamental part of my life.
That's really interesting because that was not my experience in the sense that I did not do sports, but I danced and it was very privileged. And my mom made it a huge priority for her outside of
really?
Her work was my dance.
Was she a dancer?
No, but she wanted to be.
I see. So for you, did you start very young?
2.
Do you think your girls will dance?
My girls hate dancing.
Even Mari. Do you think Mari will do
Mari it? Mari likes dancing but does not. So I didn't tell you what happened last year.
No.
So for folks who don't know, Mari's 4, right? But she's not a baby. I mean, we call her the baby. She's not a baby. Last year, she was 3.
Yes.
She's been in school since she's been 2. So she has she's socialized. She's been out of the home. She's been cared for by lots of people besides me and my husband. And last year I signed her up for ballet and she got kicked out because she cried so hard and was making such a ruckus that they asked her not to return.
See, I thought that happened to Valea.
It also happened to Valea. It also happened to Valea.
Well, let me just say this. Shout out to parents who have their own identity outside of their children, because some people would have forced their child to do it because they needed it. You know what I mean?
And the fact I was like, I'm not doing this to myself anymore. This is miserable. I would be sitting outside the classroom and just hearing her holler and scream and cry for me. I was like, this is supposed to be fun. And, she'd leave the room like 45 minutes later and it looked like her hair was a mess. Like she'd like snotty red, like.
Let me just say that, not believe, but Mari has a like chronically disheveled look to her.
Yeah, I mean, that's her thing.
So for that to have been exacerbated, it was pretty bad.
So wait, there's another story about Mari around her disheveled look. So you know how when I was in DC last week, we bought her a bonnet?
Yeah.
So we bought her a bonnet because she wakes up with her hair. And last night she couldn't find her bonnet. She's been wearing it.
That's amazing.
And she lost her shit. And Valea gave her her bonnet.
Yeah.
But Valea's bonnet is blue.
Right.
And she fell asleep going, I just want my purple bonnet. I just. Aww. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. I digress.
What's something new that you've done or experienced?
You took me to a naked spa.
Oh, tell the people. Not a sex club yet.
No.
It's baby
steps. So last week was the 2-year anniversary of my double mastectomy. And one of the things that Tashira and I are trying to do is plan for some of these big moments. And anniversaries don't always look the same, right? So they can be for hard things. And so this is something that I've reclaimed. Last year, I did a yoga class with my family and friends. And like this year, we were together, which was so special. And you designed the day. And you took me to a spa, which I love a good spa. And it was a Korean spa in Arlington?
In Alexandria.
And when I tell the people that the biggest towel there was this big, and by this big, it was like
maybe a foot and a half,
12 inches,
yeah.
18 inches, it doesn't cover any of the body parts. And so it was very interesting because at first I was like, this is going to be really hard for me. Like I'm not, well, maybe I am, right? And so I was like, here's my body. Here are my scars. Here are all my scars here. And like, no one cared.
Nobody.
It's just a body.
Well, here's the thing about it, too. You're like, oh, great. I'm going to bring my bathing suit. And I was like, no, friend. That ain't how this one is set up. It's
full. No, it's like full naked people.
It's full. It's fully.
And you're naked on a slab next to someone else. And then they scruff off all your dead skin, which is also like a whole other experience. So I really felt reborn. And then we had lunch in our pajamas at the Korean
exactly.
spa. It was kind of like the most ideal day.
Exactly. It was like an adult daytime sleepover is what it felt like.
Yeah, but it was so interesting, right? Because I think this is actually unique to DC in this way that I don't experience the same way in New England. DC really is diverse. In this like way of like different ethnicities, cultures, languages. And in that spot, it was a random day. It was like Thursday, I think, of last
during
week.
The day, like
during the day,
11.
There was you and me. There were a handful of Korean women, mm-hmm. young, old. And then there was a group of new immigrants.
Yes.
From El Salvador, who I talked to because I speak Spanish and they didn't know what to do. And they showed up in their bathing suits and you had to tell them to, to take it all off.
Exactly.
And it was so interesting because no one really could, you don't like really look at other people.
No. Which gets back to this whole like bathroom ban stuff, right? Like that's not what you're at a spa for. That's not what you go to the bathroom for.
But you did tell me that maybe it's a little different on the male side.
It is. But I mean, that's a shared agreement. They know that before they arrive. Yeah, it can get not all Korean spas, but some of them do have a bathhouse culture. By the way, people, folks who are female bodied are on one side, male bodied on another side. And on the part that caters specifically to men, there is an undertone, depending on where you go, of like, again, the kind of gay bathhouse where it's just a freaky fun time in there.
But how did they know?
I don't know, because I don't know why we don't have it on our side.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, here we go, the patriarchy again. Shit. We can't even get down at the spa.
Well, I mean, I'm grateful for that, but like, I don't know. I mean, I guess I just don't understand like all of these unspoken rules. Like why on the women, on the female body side, it's like, we're all very respectful. Everyone's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then on the man's side, it's like, let me touch your penis.
Yeah.
Do I ask permission to do that?
It's given very Lauren Bobart. Yeah. A handful of penis. Yeah, that's what be going down sometime over there. And I mean, I've never been.
Wait, do you think people match and then go there?
So there's some of that jacked and grinder culture, right? Where you kind
of... For those of us who don't know what jacked is.
Yeah, just
like it sounds. It's different than grinder.
So they're both hookup apps.
No, I know what grinder is.
Oh, okay. Jacked is the same thing.
But what?
Yeah, I mean, they're just two different hookup apps. Now, obviously, people who are more well-versed may be able to tell you the nuances and the differences between the two. But from my understanding, they're both hookup apps that gay men use. And so there may be some matching before you arrive or obviously while you're there. But
no, but you can't bring your phone.
But you can bring it to like the locker room, but you can't bring it to the other parts. But I also think once again, people know which spas are set up for what. Exactly. So there's a bit of like self-selection happening as well.
That wasn't happening on our side.
It wasn't happening, unfortunately.
Or fortunately.
It was pretty straight and narrow. We just got our skin rubbed raw.
Yeah, but that was a really new experience for me.
Yeah, that was something. I'm happy that we were able to. But at first you were like, oh, the towel, where's the thing? And I was like, Margo, stop. You've been through a lot. We've both been through a lot. We're just going to embrace the newness of this moment. And you did so good, friend.
Thank you.
You were like, okay, I'll do.
You know, sometimes I have some fear and then I can do it. I can do all things.
Yeah. Amen. That's the affirmation.
And I think that even if my natural instinct is to feel embarrassed or shame, I'm working so hard not to, that I wouldn't want to disappoint myself in that way.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. It's about embracing our bodies, embracing who we are at all seasons of life.
And it was so amazing to see like that was just how it was. Not that, I mean, I don't even know what I would mean by like a perfect body, but like there were so many bodies.
Exactly.
And they were all perfect.
Exactly. Because it's the body that we have.
Yeah.
And that's just that on that.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Dumb quote of the day. Dumb shit men say.
Woo. All right. Here's the thing. So today's dumb shit, people say, comes from one known as Joseph Biden, the president of the United States, who we know, Joe's up there. Joe's at a big age.
Joe's up there. Joe, he's at a big, big age.
He's at a big, big age. And this is what he had to say recently as it related to the 50th anniversary of hip hop, which is this year. He just really has not been able to get it together. So he's at an event and he starts to fumble over different rappers' names while trying to recognize them. MC Light definitely had to like help him out. But at one point, this is what he says about LL Cool J. He says, two of the greatest artists of our time represented by the groundbreaking legacy of hip hop in America. LL Cool J, by the way, that man's got biceps bigger than my thighs. And I think what people have really honed in here about Margo is Brother Joe's use of the term boy, but also how it relates to him not knowing who any of these hip hop artists are. One of the genres that has had most profound effect on not just US culture, but across the world. What is your opinion, friend?
So understanding that people who've been elected to positions of power can't be experts on everything.
Very
so true. Giving him grace there. And that LL Cool J is one of the most renowned artists of all time.
Oh.
Okay, I'm giving him grace there. I think his use of boy is very problematic. And it harkens back to other things he said in the past that he has been critiqued for. So it makes me think he doesn't actually know what he's saying or how he's saying it or how it's coming off.
Mm-hmm.
So the history of the use of the word boy as it relates to a black man, I mean.
Yeah, for sure. So much so that I really dislike, and I remember being at a car dealership one time with my grandparents, and they were buying a car, and this very young white man was calling my grandfather by his first name, and I just really did not like it, because while he didn't call my grandfather boy, I thought to myself, it's no way that if this was a white man, you would not have used
Mister.
It's no way. So there's something there about the way that the Black body is seen, right? It is an example of anti-Black racism in our society, and that Black folks and Black men in particular in this case can be referenced as boy when LL Cool J is 60 years old. Okay, this is someone late 50s, early 60s.
No,
he's nobody's boy.
Yeah. Well, I also think it's something that President Biden is doing to like give himself proximity to Black people.
We've seen it before.
Right. And he did this recently when he was running for president this time on Charlemagne Tha God. And he said something to the effect of, if you don't vote for me, you ain't Black.
Joe, why did you say that?
Do you know who else said something really problematic on Charlemagne Tha God? Hillary Clinton.
Wait, what did she say?
I forget, but it was something similarly offensive. And so there's something that he feels uncomfortable.
For sure. For sure.
And that discomfort is translating into him using anti-Black racist tropes.
Because that's what he knows intuitively, either because he believes them or because he's of a certain age and time period, right? So his handlers are writing these talking points for him that he's fumbling over.
Because they don't feel natural to him.
And so he's just saying what he knows. And it's interesting because we know that, you know, Joe and others were part of this kind of super predator narrative around young people who were caught up in a pipeline to prison and mass incarceration in the 80s and
90s.
And he's held some welfare reform, and he's held some pretty problematic views over time. And so I know that he has worked to distance himself from those beliefs, but moments like this make you think that he's the same person and he really does still believe those same things. But also, I was talking to my cousin Taylan recently. We were talking about Angela Davis. And I was like, I don't understand how this woman is in her 70s, probably, right?
Probably.
And she still is able to kind of get it right. Like, how has her analysis not become stale? How is it not dated, right? She has understood to embrace trans people, right? To embrace queer people. I think that in the case of her justice politic and analysis, it's just prescient. It has remained timeless. And Taylan said something to me that I will never forget. He said it's because she sees people in their fullest humanity.
Taylan.
And she always has. So there's no separation of a social construct or identity because she sees people as humans. And I think that's what we get wrong. That's why you're able to be seen as progressive in your younger years and, you know, be following Saul Alinsky's rules for radicals. And then you get 80 and you're saying things like boy when you are talking about a grown man, because you never saw people different than you in their fullest humanity.
Thank you, Professor Halyard, for that.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know what else.
And also, why isn't he better prepped? I'm sorry. Like, giving him all of the grace, and he's president of the United States. He won the election because of the Black vote.
Yes. Yes.
Do we all remember South Carolina?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so, but for that, he would not be president.
Yes. Yes. I mean, talk about that, Margot, right? Because I think
not that that's the reason, but
no, but let's just keep it a stack. Like, a population of people helped to get you elected.
Just learn.
It's not that hard.
Right? Like, you always ask me thoughtful inquiries about my Jewish heritage and practice, as I hope I do to you about your spirituality and where you came from. It's okay to be inquisitive about stuff you don't know.
Yeah.
I know he has a lot of Black people on his staff.
The vice president being one of them.
Oh my God, I totally forgot she was.
Me too. So.
Whoa. But like his communications director. I mean.
I just, you know.
I just don't understand.
Brother Joe. Brother Joe. You know, it's like, I don't see it for old Joe. I don't. And it is, we are in such a difficult time right now, right? Like, what is we gonna do, Margo? We don't have a lot of time to get it together. They are coming for our ass. They are already here. What are we going to do?
We have to vote for him. But that doesn't mean we can't help him be better. So I think holding people accountable and knowing that some choice is better than no choice is we can hold both dualities. I think we don't have a choice. Okay.
Oh, God. More on election and Brother Biden.
But language is important, obviously. I mean, we don't need to say that to our audience, right? But
poor Joe.
Poor Joe. Okay. Let's talk about today's episode about people pleasing.
Yeah.
And why this felt like we needed to talk about during this phase.
Yeah, because I think we have discussed how it's taken on different hues over the years. And I think even for me personally, when I am at my best and the most kind of like firm 10 toes down in my boundaries, there's still an element of that I have, especially as it relates to my family. Mm. And I think that some of that is cultural, and it is like this reverential way that I was raised to see the elders in my family. And so it's like, they call, they need, they want, everything stops. It's all about pleasing them and doing for them.
Yeah. And I think like a lot of the episodes and conversations that we have, it's not one way. Yeah. So we're not saying like blanket people pleasing or doing things for others that don't feel good for us is bad.
Yeah.
We're just saying like, why are we doing it? Why? And why do we care?
And when?
And when should we care?
And when should we care? Because I would think that there's some element of people pleasing or behaviors that might be characterized that way that like earlier in our careers may have been really useful. They may have opened certain doors for us, right? But the question is, when do we cut it off? And when do we decide that it's no longer serving us? And when is it time to change those behaviors?
And when is it okay just to let it go? Like when we're not pleasing those, either that we want to or that we're not pleasing people we don't care about and we should just let that go too. So this really kind of has been percolating for me. Earlier last month, I had the opportunity to do my first keynote, which was like a bucket list item. It's something I've wanted to do forever. It was a really big audience. It was around 500 people at a violence prevention conference. And it was something that I had been really looking forward to for a long time. And as I was driving to New Hampshire, I was overwhelmed with imposter syndrome and this fear, like this deep fear that like, what if they don't like me? Mm. What are they? And I kept being like, it's not about that. And I really had to kind of go myopic into my prepared remarks and focus on the Tashira Barbie doll that I brought and put on the podium and not look at the audience, because I was really worried that I was going to look at the audience and someone in there who was like looking at their phone or not paying attention or grimacing and feel like I had failed. Mm. And I really had to sit with that, like, wow, maybe this isn't where I'm supposed to be. Maybe I'm not ready for this. Maybe this isn't kind of an item that I should repeat, because this felt very hard. I really enjoyed it in the moment. But the buildup and then afterwards, not getting feedback, you know, keynotes are weird at conferences, right? Because you like kick off a conference and then you don't see people again, because I just stayed for the day, but it was a 4-day conference or 3-day conference. Anyway, and as I was like driving home and over the last couple weeks thinking about it, it was not my job for them to like me.
Hey, come on, gospel.
Right? And actually, if they all liked me, I didn't do a good job, because I was trying to provoke a conversation that wasn't happening that much. Mm. It was a violence prevention conference that had amalgamation of law enforcement, social workers, case managers, lawyers, legal services, right? Lots of different people. And I was really challenging them to get out of their lanes, right? That if we only focus on the work from a myopic lens, we lose the mission. That is not what people have been trained to
think.
It's not
what they're currently doing.
Right. And so, of course, they might not like me, even though I was an incredible speaker.
Of course.
And no, but you know, I gave really tangible nuggets. I gave examples. I gave suggestions. I gave support. Yeah. I gave encouragement. I gave perspective on how I came to this. I gave it my own personal story. And it just got me thinking, like, wow, I waste and have wasted so much time in my life worrying if people like me.
Can we bring gender into this for a second?
Yeah.
I think that men are socialized to have half the amount of like brilliance and professional experiences you have and have twice the amount of confidence. So getting in front of a room and thinking, will people like me? Very often is the last thing on their mind. So there's something about the way that we are socialized that I think also plays into this conversation.
Well, it's something that you and I've talked about a lot about the term dynamic. Mm-hmm. Right. I've heard that term so much as it relates to men in power. Right. They're dynamic. They have interests outside of the workplace. They're, you know, participants in the home. Right. And you never hear women or people who identify as women, or I haven't, described of as dynamic.
Yeah. You're supposed to be able to do it all.
Right. And like Obama was described as dynamic all the time. He played basketball. He was a dad. He was a president. He was a husband. He, you know, was on Harvard Law Review. Like he was a great speaker. You know who's dynamic in that relationship?
Michelle.
Always has a seat here on Justice Pod.
Michelle, we would gladly welcome you.
We will even fly you to Boston.
We will replace the gavel with your face and our logo.
Yes. We will come to you on Martha's Vineyard.
Of course.
Anyway, but it was always so interesting in that dynamic, I thought, right? Because she really was the one who had a hard time and was criticized in the press.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, I mean, he was also criticized, but like of the two.
In a different way. I mean, she was definitely criticized. She was criticized in a way that plays into this trope around Black womanhood in particular.
And
but
being
I think
angry.
Yeah. But any woman who has an opinion and you know
and is protective of their family.
Exactly. It receives the same kind of vitriol in the press. Yeah. So she wasn't even given the opportunity to be liked, let alone being a people pleaser. Right. And isn't that so interesting?
And also, you know, I wonder if there's some race dynamics too in pleasing, right? Because I think you and I've talked about it as related to work.
Yeah.
Right? Where there are things that I do that you interpret as pleasing other people for no reason.
What do you mean?
So I think there's some things that maybe I do that you interpret as pleasing people who don't have, like, who don't deserve our time.
Mm, yeah. It's funny because when we first started off, like, with our calls and stuff, you'd be like, Shishara, your poker face is fucking terrible. Because if I'm not with the shits, I'm not with it. Like, I don't hide my face. And it's not that I intend to be rude or malicious. It's just I am transparent about how I feel very
right.
often.
And so maybe this goes back to white politeness.
Mm, right? Come on, bring this home.
Right. And so this idea of like me maybe not being transparent because I feel like I constantly have to please or at least keep up appearances. And you're like, this isn't going to go anywhere, Margo. Like,
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of value.
Yeah, for sure. So for folks who don't know what we're talking about, if this is your first time joining. We talked about the idea of white politeness in an episode that's in our private community. Join if you would like to tune in. And that episode was about value of time. And we brought it up again since as it relates to a lot of the hate comments that we received. But when I used that term, I was talking about this cultural norm that exists sometimes in white communities where I think women especially are taught to not be direct, to be overly polite, in some ways to be passive and submissive. And that shows up in the workplace in a way that can honestly be very violent because I think we can be sitting down at a table and think that all is well. And then the next thing I know, we go to my performance review and it's needs improvement. But wait a minute, I thought that we were cool. We have this rapport, et cetera, right? It is this culture of politeness that says I should lead with the nice thing to do. I should lead with what is going to make other people happy and please other people.
Have you heard of the sandwich?
Oh, about sandwiching feedback.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Listen, just because I don't always seek to be polite and respectable, it doesn't mean that I want to be mean or rude. And so you know the people in your life and whether or not the sandwich is really going to work. And by sandwich, we mean taking the thing that may be perceived as negative.
Or like an opportunity or something you need to work on.
And then sandwiching in between two things that are. I think the problem sometimes is that folks can lose the thing that needs to be worked on, depending on the space they're in.
So it's really interesting because I think we need to be able to receive constructive feedback better.
Mm.
And I don't believe in the sandwich.
Okay.
Because I think that, so this, maybe I have like this duality to my personality, right? And I'm new to business. So I think I'm giving myself grace here too. But I remember when I started teaching, particularly running my own clinic, I was really concerned about students liking me and getting, you know, positive teaching evaluations. And then a couple of years in, I was like, that's not my job.
Yeah. Amen.
Right. My job is to help them be good lawyers. And if they don't like me, that's not my problem. Right. This is a hard clinic. This is hard work. If they're not doing the work and not representing the clients well and not doing their homework, I have to give them constructive feedback because that's going to serve them in their career. Me pretending like they're doing a good job is actually a disservice.
Yeah. And for you, you have that unique perspective as well as an educator, as someone in higher ed. Absolutely.
But that, you know, as I kind of think back, there was also an inherent power dynamic there. I was their professor.
So then how do we...
So how do we do it when we're more in parity?
Yeah, like in a relationship or when the power dynamic is different, when it's our parents, when it's the elders in our life. How do we not engage in those actions? I mean, for me, here's how my people pleasing shows up. I am spread very thin, and the people in my life who know me personally know this. And for me, it started very young because I was raised in this very kind of community-centered way. And so it's almost as if I'm everybody's child, I'm everybody's grandchild, I'm everybody's sister, I'm everybody's cousin, right? Everyone had a role to play in my family dynamic. And it's true, like we all are a unit. And because I did not grow up with a traditional mom and dad nuclear kind of family dynamic, it means that I kind of have two moms, right? I got my grandmama and I got my mama. And so there's always someone who I feel like I am inherently letting down. There's someone's phone call I cannot take during the day. There is someone who I'm not going to be able to call back. And now when you multiply that by a growing audience throughout social media and different platforms and justice, I mean, it's always a comment I can't get back to. There's always a DM that I can't respond to. And it is probably one of the biggest pieces of anxiety that I have. And the question is, why do I feel like I have to be available? Why do I feel that way?
I don't know. Because you would give, so this is what I don't understand. Why do we feel this way if this is not the advice we would give to our younger selves?
Yeah. Or to our friend, to our family member.
Right. I would say to you, Tashira, not everyone owns a piece of you. Only share when you're ready.
Yeah.
Particularly to the audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, because, so full disclosure moment, trigger warning for people who are suffering through mental health issues. This may be a part of the episode that you want to skip. But I had a full-on anxiety attack after Fashion Week. And I think it relates to people pleasing, Margot, because I felt like I owed my audience an inordinate amount of content that no one person could ever keep up with. I was trying to post across platforms multiple times a day. I was trying to write a newsletter, write a blog post, link the thing. People ask me what a thing, respond to the comments, be on this. While my grandparents were in town and they need a lot of help and support from me, while I'm running other parts of my business, while we have a podcast. So I am getting little sleep and I'm working constantly. And I'm also, at that time, I was off my anxiety medications, my SSRI. And in the moment that my mind was racing 1,000 miles per minute, I did not even miss a beat. The thought came into my head so quickly of, I understand why people end their life. I completely understand why they do, because how could you live like this when you feel such a crippling amount of anxiety that is just consuming every part of your brain and your body? And it was my first kind of real mindful moment of a suicidal ideation in that way. And it scared the fuck out of me. And I quickly consulted people in my life who I love. Please do the same if you're having the same feelings.
Absolutely.
Got back on my medication, scheduled with a therapist, got in with the doctor, did all the things I'm supposed to do. But what triggered it, oh, and then I had this issue with a family member that came up as well, right? What triggered it was the attempt to please, and pleasing to perfection.
And pleasing to this unknown amount of expectation. Like, what would have been enough to make you say, like, I'm good?
Exactly. I'd already given so much. So why couldn't I just say that?
Right. So why? I mean, capitalism. I don't know what it is. Like,
yeah.
Like, would there ever be a time with being a content creator in this capacity where you feel like I did my work for the day?
Yes.
Okay. So yes. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well. Will there always be work to be done? Absolutely. I could be working while I could be filming myself sleep and make a reel from that, right? There will always be work that can be done. Will there be a moment when I say I'm done? That is what I'm currently working on and defining for myself. Because I think this kind of go, 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 please, 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 be available, do all the things at all the time, that is a business model that, one, is impractical, but two, speaks to, I think, just getting the bag. It speaks to like a scarcity mindset around money and capitalism and the economic system.
Also, I also think it speaks to this American ideal of never working enough.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right. Because I don't know. I don't know. I'm not an expert in other countries and places, though I have had the opportunity to travel. I don't get this sense, both interpersonally or professionally in other countries, where people feel so overwhelmed. I mean, some people for sure, but like overwhelmed by their obligations to produce.
Yeah. Yeah. And are solely defined by that as well. Like, you're doing well because you have done something that other people could not do. So it's almost like your success is solely defined by you being able to separate yourself from people who are not as strong as you, who need more sleep than you, who need more rest and water and food, you know, natural human things.
Well, so it also kind of goes back to one of the conversations we had last season, and I think we'll continue to have in different ways, right, about the value of time, right? But, and I've been talking a lot with my therapist about decoupling an individual's worth from their identity, right? And sometimes those things are together, right? But you don't want to get all your worth from your one identity.
For sure.
Right? Particularly if you're we're all multi-hyphenate, right?
Yeah.
And how we define worth, right? So in America, right, it's like title, job, salary, family status, children, right? Like, there are all these different things that people feel like they need to check off. But there's always going to be another thing to check off if you have one, but you don't have the other. But like, and when can you just be like, this is what's going to please me?
Yes. Yes.
This is what I want.
And defining that for yourself is the work. And it is so hard. And I also think it's ever changing.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's also not static. So I even think back to us last year, right? As we were starting this new endeavor and what we thought of as success. And like, we hit that. And now we're like, that's not success. How did we get there so quickly? Like, remember when we did our dream list and going to PlannerCon? We were like, someday we're going to go to PlannerCon. Like, it was like a joke dream. And then within 8 months, we were invited to be their keynote speaker. And now we're like.
And not only that, but now it's hard to keep up. And we're not even, I feel like, fully present and mindful of the blessing in the moment. And that is the mind fuck that it is so easy to get into when we are disembodied, right? When we are not in ourselves and defining these things for ourselves.
And it's also so interesting, right? Because I would give ourselves a little more grace. Like, I feel like we're learning, right, how to enjoy stuff a little bit more. We don't. So I think for those of you who've listened for all three seasons, you know that we used to batch our recordings in 2-day clumps. And now we don't do that anymore because it's too hard.
Yeah.
And so we're still batch recording, but only on one day. And then we'll record in next month.
Yeah.
Likely. And we're going to do some more remote recordings and kind of more live events, right, to kind of diversify what that looks like. I don't know if you've had similar experiences because, well, I'd be interested to hear. So people will often ask me, like, how's the podcast going? And I will say, great, I think. Right? Because to me, it's such a source of joy.
Yeah.
Right? We're growing. We are learning. We're expanding our audience. You know, we've broken even, which I hear is a big deal in the first year, right? We're starting to have speaking engagements and training engagements and corporate events and live taping, right? So we're in a very different place than we were last year.
Yeah.
But we're certainly not, I don't know, successful like Goop or, you know, any of the ones that are already on Spotify that are sponsored and produced by Spotify. But that to me shouldn't be the compare, like, we started from nothing.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. I like to say we got it out of the mud. And this is true for, I think, so many people who are solopreneurs. And so showing ourselves grace and not pleasing those outside of us is an ongoing process.
And figuring out, like, who you do need to please, though, to do your work.
Well, let's talk about that.
Because that's part of business.
Exactly. So I think we're talking about people pleasing from a business standpoint, but also what about people pleasing those in your life? Like, friends have been a big topic on this podcast, especially as it relates to, like, time and how we define our priorities at a big age. What does it mean to be a people pleaser in friendships? And have you ever been one of those?
Guilty.
Okay. How did it show up for you?
I think for me, it's shown up that, you know, I grew up as primarily an only child. I was pretty lonely and had like a best friend always who didn't go to my school. My friend Nora, we were in different grades and different schools in different towns. And I always had one or two close friends in elementary and middle school, but I always really wanted a big group of friends. Like, that was something. As an only child, it like really felt like I was missing that gang.
Yeah.
You know? And when it started happening for me in college, I felt like it was like quicksand. Like, I didn't want to let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a lot of my, you know, college 20s and 30s, I spent a lot of time maintaining relationships that didn't serve me.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, you want to have coffee? Sure. Oh, you want to get a drink? Sure. Oh, you need me to help you do this like random thing? Sure. And some of those adventures were really fun. But I think when I look back, I maintained a lot of friendships that weren't necessarily the healthiest or didn't serve me.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did it show up for you?
Yeah. But I want to respond to you really quickly because I remember when we met, you were post law school, maybe a year or.
I graduated in 2007. And so we met in 2010.
Okay. Yeah. So you were a few years outside of law school, but I remember some of our like early transparent conversations about struggles and challenges you were having with like this specific friend group. And so I remember when that was a time in your life that was very tender, especially as you became a new parent and they weren't parents and kind of how those relationships changed. And so, yes, I definitely remember and understand that because I think I, too, always just wanted a peer group. Like, I always wanted friends. And for different reasons for me, although I was kind of raised as an only child because I don't have any full siblings. I was also raised by grandparents who just didn't understand friends. And this is true for very many like Black elders, particularly in the South. It's like the only friend you need is Jesus. You don't need.
But that's so funny because I experienced your grandma as the most social person on the planet. But she also has a lot of siblings.
And that was the model that I understood, because I'd never known my grandma to have friends that she was not related to.
Oh.
I think I've only known her to have one or two, like, girlfriends. But again, some sort of way they were connected to our larger family group. But as to, like, go to work and be friends with her coworkers and go on girls' trips or do a girls' night out, girl, please. No. No sleepovers were allowed for a number of reasons. Some of those safety, but no sleepovers were allowed. Nobody was like taking me and my friends to the movies. Like, we weren't having these kind of very normative experiences that young people tend to have with their friends. And so as I got older, I really, really, really wanted that. And my favorite series of books were Babysitter's Club and Girl Talk, right? Same. So you just, you know, understood that you were kind of one of these characters of young people. And you were supposed to have a group of friends. Again, the ways in which we are indoctrinated and conditioned to see ourselves in the world. And so your friend or not having a friend group kind of meant so much. And so when you got it, you just wanted to please people and to make everyone happy. And fast forward to today, and I don't feel that as strongly. And I think I have curated a group of friends who love me so much until they get that I'm pulled a million different ways. But there are times when I feel like I am doing things just to please people because I don't want to make them upset because my time is so limited. And so I don't want them to feel left out. What can I do, even if it is against my own self-interest?
Yeah. I don't want that for you.
I know.
And one of the things, and I wouldn't wish this on you at all. I wouldn't wish this on anyone. That I have experienced over the last couple of years is even trying to please isn't going to please, right? So like there are people who are going to have opinions about your life and how you spend time and how you live. Even if you're trying to please them at the same time, that's going to impact how they relate to you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So I think a lot of people had a lot, we've talked about this, but like a lot of opinions about me leaving my job.
Yeah.
People had a lot of opinions about me sharing my medical story. People had a lot of opinions about being so public about certain things. And I think that's like, notwithstanding how much I try to please them in my personal life with them, those are the feelings that they're going to harbor.
It's so funny because, like, to your point about dualities, I think I understand that intuitively about people outside of my family and friend circle. Right? Like the way that you understood that about your students, like I just got to keep it straight, no chaser, is the way that I understand that about individuals for the most part online. Do I feel this compulsion to create, to feed the machine, to please the machine in that way? Yes. But people's opinions of my life online, I don't give a fuck.
So that's a really interesting kind of slicing the onion.
Yeah, it really isn't. And I wonder.
I mean, I'm glad for you that you don't internalize
that. Yeah, well, I don't think I could do what I do if I did. No. Right? Because we've already had an episode. I don't know if it's aired yet or not. But an episode about negative comments that we receive. And so I think for both of us, if we allow for other people who we don't know, for their comments on our lives to shape how we live our lives, we definitely would not have a podcast.
And I think, I don't know if you feel this way, but I have really kind of like feel this to my core that for people kind of, people online, I try very hard not to internalize those kind of personal jabs at me because they don't know me. But for people who are in my life who have opinions about certain things that have nothing to do with our relationship, like our relationship or our friendship, I also feel like there's nothing I can do because I have never felt kind of happier professionally and like more present in my life. And I would only want that for people I love.
Amen. Amen.
Right. And so if people, like, that's where I think my people-pleasing kind of tendencies have just been unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the universe.
It's also big age. I mean, we said we were going to, you know, put this in a frame of big age. I mean, I would love to for our audience to think about this as well. You know, if you were over the age of 35, if you're over the age of 40, Are you a people pleaser? And what has changed in your life, you know, around pleasing or not? I would like to think for me, there was something about me getting breast cancer when my mom was treating breast cancer that a switch went off in my brain in a real way. And there were parts of my life and how I was showing up that I just was no longer willing to compromise. So that part of the onion, of the people-pleasing layer, kind of was shed. And maybe that's what happens, right? We go through life experiences and another layer is shed and another layer is shed until we, you know, reach this point of self-actualization. I don't know.
I don't know, because I think it's still, I mean, it's like this thing about it always being evolving and always coming back.
Yeah.
Right? Because you think you make all this progress and then you're like driving on 93 being like, what if they don't like me? What if they don't like me? Right? And it was, I mean, maybe for me, that was the moment where I was like, maybe I haven't done that much work. Maybe I haven't worked on this thing the way I think I have.
Can I bring in Marianne Williamson?
Yes, and please.
Okay, I just want to bring
in. You know, she's running for president.
She's
also a big fan of your boyfriend, Jim Loke.
And is she?
Yes.
And we've met Jim Loke. That means we basically met Marianne Williamson. Mm-hmm. This is amazing.
You know, Marianne Williamson was Gabby Bernstein's mentor.
Well, that's why I'm bringing her up.
Okay, sorry.
Obviously, Margot. So as we think about this from like the Course on Miracles, what they would say is that's just fear. And so it's that new experiences might be sparking that tendency towards people pleasing because the new experiences are igniting a certain amount of fear in us. And so, you know, as Marianne would say, maybe our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate, but that we are powerful beyond measure. Are you laughing?
For a second, I thought you were being serious.
Because I was, bitch.
Okay, so here's where I didn't lose you. I think she's onto something.
Okay.
With a new experience, triggering something in us. Right? That, like, you put your toe in. You don't know if the water's going to be cold. The water's fine. You do it, and then you do the thing again, and you're not as fearful, and you don't have as much fear. I can put my head around that.
So, yeah, I think there is likely something there. Because if, again, it's a constant type of, like, ebb and flow, the reality is the more we achieve goals and the more we're able to kind of check off boxes and these big experiences that we want, there's just a fearful element around it. That's what growth requires. And so I'm wondering then if it also takes us to do that wrestling work with people pleasing as well.
So can I add something into this conversation? I wish someone had told us, or someone is telling our younger listeners and viewers, that the only person you need to please is yourself.
Shondo.
Because I spent so long being fearful of not pleasing all of these different people in my life, my parents, my bosses, like, right, that I really, and I think I kind of got to this quicker than a lot of people because I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
But figuring out what it was going to take to please me so that, I mean, not to be like, put on your own oxygen mask. But it is. Because if you don't have oxygen, you're not breathing and you're dead. There's no, like, mom's home, cooking dinner, cooking breakfast. Like, if you're dead, you're dead.
Yeah, I mean, this is Margot's second time talking about her death today. So we're going to have a whole conversation.
It's the drugs. It is.
But yes. No.
No, but there is this thing that I wish someone would have said to me, like, Margot, what are your personal goals?
Mm.
Like, what do you want for yourself?
Yeah.
Not outside of yourself. Not like, I want to buy a house by 30, or I want to have kids, or I want to get married. Like, what is personal contentment to you, you 25-year-old? Yeah. How are you going to calm your nervous system when you're having a panic attack? Yeah. What does a nourishing meal look like to you? I don't know. Like, all of these things that I received a lot of messages about what to do to please others, but I never received or learned those messages about myself.
Question. Do you feel like our parents had a role to play in that?
So I feel like my mom, yes, but I feel like my mom taught me how to take care of myself. But also was working a full-time job, had two kids. My dad had his own business. They were really stressed financially, right? And I think that both my parents were caring for others. Mm-hmm. Like they were caring for me and my brother. They were caring for my grandparents. They were caring for their businesses. But yes, I mean, I think I did learn a lot about tools. Like my dad, when he turned 40, like my dad was joking. When I left Northeastern, he was not happy. And my mom goes to him, well, she's not the only one in the family who blew up their life at 40. And I had forgotten. My dad left for a month when he turned 40 and climbed Mount Aconcagua in Argentina. Do you know
what? Wait, what?
I never told you this story.
For a fucking month?
He left. And he climbed the highest mountain in the Southern Hemisphere. And he was a model for the clothing company.
Well, clearly, because your dad is big fine.
Yeah, he's so cute.
But wait, but tell me, how did he negotiate that with your mom?
We should ask her. I think, you know, she wasn't happy about it.
Well, I mean, this also goes back to the point I was making earlier about people pleasing being gendered in a particular
way. Yeah, I don't think my dad cared.
Because there's no way your mom would have said, backhand, deuces, I'm out.
Do you know what my mom did as soon as... I never told you this story.
No.
You know what she did as soon as he left?
What did she do?
She bought a fur coat. So now, in retrospect, it might not have been like the best time in their marriage. Like, neither was happy.
Does she still have the coat?
Yeah, of course, because you can't wear a fur coat or sell a fur coat now. Who would wear a fur coat? It's like, so it's an investment that has zero value. But I think you bring up a good point. Like, my dad was like, I need to do this.
Yeah.
I need a break. I'm sick of running my business. I'm sick of all this financial responsibility. They were trying to get pregnant with my brother. It was very stressful.
Yeah.
And he just was like.
That, and I'm also thinking about the amount of like planning and prep that must have taken.
Like, it was a huge trip. I mean, like, crampons, ice, backpack, like. Oxygen, like, oh, very scary. Shit. I mean, very intense. Like, but it was interesting, right? Because it was a very funny quote from my mom, because my mom was also not happy that I left my job.
Yeah.
But she was like, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, I get that you need a break or whatever, and you are very much like your father. You know? But I think that to the gendered aspect, my mom never would have left.
No. And she only had one child at that time. So she could have, right?
Yeah, of course.
Well, she could have made a greater case for it.
Of course. Because
it was before your brother was born.
Yeah, of course. But like, she wouldn't have left me for a month.
No way. It is no way. And so that's also what I mean about like this caretaking expectation. And so like, while I was caring for my grandparents, I remember someone suggested like, oh, you know, let so-and-so do this thing for them. And I was like, no, they you know, like that person can't do it. And they were like, why? And I was like, oh, it's because I'm saying that because he's a boy. You see? Like, my conditioning has been conditioned. Like, I caught myself. Like, I was like, the reason I think that is because I have been socialized to care for them in a particular way that the male-bodied people in my family have not been socialized to care for them.
And do you feel like you've done that at your own physical and mental expense?
So the great part is that obviously my mom is around, my aunt is around, and so my aunt plays a big part of caring for them, like, in the house physically when she's not working on the road. And my mom does so financially and medical decisions, et cetera. So I do not at all mean to like intimate that I'm doing this all on my own. My part to play is actually very small compared to theirs, but the responsibility is great. And the expectation is as well.
Yeah. I just think that the gendered aspect is real. I have a friend who kind of has so much responsibility in her extended family, particularly around managing the estates of loved ones who've passed and negotiating elders in her family's medical decisions. And I don't see the male-bodied people in her family doing any of that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they're not expected to, or I don't know.
So it's one of these things where we've touched on career, we've touched on family life. It is a tendency that permeates every part of who we are.
So one area that we haven't really touched on, which I think we're just going to have to move into another episode, is how this shows up for us in our intimate relationships, which I think it shows up for us very differently. Although obviously there's overlap.
Yeah.
And I know and respect that you don't want to share much about your personal life. But I think to the extent we can talk in generalities, how does that show up for you?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I'm dating, and I think that that won't be a surprise to people who listen to our Sex and Dating in Your 40s episode from season one. If you haven't, go back and listen. I'm just not being transparent about, like, where I am, with whom, and where we are.
No, but I just mean, like, in general, like, in an intimate relationship, for how sure. does this show up for you?
So here's the thing, right? I have spent time feeling like a failure in previous relationships because I felt like I haven't been present. Because it's two reasons. Number one, I am very independent. I am very much like, if this is a thing that I want to do, it is my responsibility to figure it out on my own. No one ever told me that, but that's just kind of how I have interpreted my world and my life. So got it out of the mud, right? And so that makes me not always be very trusting of a partner. And I feel like when I realize that I'm going like full steam ahead with work, with dreams, with goals, I look up and I'm like, oh shit, like, have I done enough for my partner? And there have been times where I felt like I'm failing because I cannot do it all. And that's never really the assignment. Do I need to be present in my relationship? Sure. But that starts first with being present with myself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about pleasing my partner.
Yeah. It's such a tough one. Because there's also this line, I think, and this gendering of roles, right? That like we take on or we don't take on. And I also have felt like not a great partner at times for reasons more just that I feel like I caretake for so many people that I don't sometimes want to take care of my partner too, or feel like that's my role.
Yeah.
Even if my partner might want that in the moment. And so I end up feeling bad as well. But I think we shared a little bit about this, and I think it's a nugget that maybe we like end the episode on, which has actually nothing to do with my partner, my husband, who I love very much, obviously. But even after being married for so long, I've been married for 14 years. We've been together for 17 years.
Wow.
I still, to this day, feel uncomfortable when someone describes me as his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I don't love him or respect him or think he's smart, funny, interesting, but that I interpret that as my role, like that they see that as my assignment.
Yeah.
And that's not the assignment that I'm good at.
Talk about it. Well, not even that you're good at, but that's not the assignment that was ever intended for you.
Right. And as a feminist, as a strong woman, like, wait, here I am. I'm my own person. I'm not this person's wife.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't want him to feel bad. Like he thinks that I don't want to be aligned with him or supportive of him, or it's very confusing for me.
Yeah.
And you would think after all this time it wouldn't be. But I was saying yesterday, I went to an event and it was an event at Josh's work. And I didn't know a lot of people, and he was kind of doing his thing with people he works with. And a bunch of people came up to me and they were like, what's your connection to this company? I was like, oh, I'm so-and-so's wife. And I was like,
and you could have said, Josh is my husband.
Right. And I said something to one of my friends, like how uncomfortable this made me feel. And she was like, well, you know, like everyone in the world thinks that Josh is Margot's husband. And I was like, oh my God, I hadn't even thought about it that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense because I think there is this element of people pleasing that shows up in our personal, like our intimate partner relationships as well. And I think it's a bit different for queer relationships. I mean, not to say that gender stuff does not play into it because we live in a gender binary. And so you'll be surprised how many queer people still subscribed based upon their identity and expression, still subscribe to a lot of those kind of dominant norms and traits. I think what I have found out is as I pursue dating and a love life this time around at a big age, like renewed, and I feel like I've been given another chance to just try things differently, it is a communication piece for me. Like having a consistent conversation about what lands for that other person in ways that I can help fill their cup in ways that I'm sorry, but I just cannot do that thing, right? Like as much as you may want me to like wake up in the morning with you and have coffee before you go to work, babe, I'm not good at it. Like I am not my best before 8 a.m. I can't. But what I can do is have a great dinner, or we can order in, or we can go out, and I got you when you come home. Like, that's my time to shine, right? And so it's not about pleasing as much as it is partnership.
Yes. I think we should end there. But I think maybe another episode on, like, how we internalize or don't pleasing in an intimate relationship would be valuable.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you all so much for tuning in today. We will see you next time.
Thanks, everyone.